Hello, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Criminally Listed Presents Into the Killing. This episode is going to be a little bit different than the other episodes. In most episodes, we usually try to make the identity of the killer a mystery until the very end. In this case, there is no secret regarding the identity of the killer. His name is John Emil List. Even though the police knew the identity of the killer, it would still almost take 2 decades for him to be convicted. So let's go back to when this horrific crime happened. It was the second week in November 1971. The president was Richard Nixon. On November 8, 1971, rock band Led Zeppelin released their legendary album, Led Zeppelin 4, featuring their best-known song, Stairway to Heaven. The album would go on to sell over 37 million copies worldwide. When that classic album was released, the List family was living in a rundown mansion in Westfield, New Jersey. Westfield is only about 20 miles from downtown New York City. 46-year-old John List and his 46-year-old wife, Helen, had 3 children, 16-year-old Patricia, 15-year-old John Jr., and 13-year-old Frederick. Also living with the family was John's 84-year-old mother, Alma. None of the children attended school on November 10, 1971. But then, the schools received letters from John List. He wrote that they were planning on going out of town for several weeks to take care of a relative who was ill. After that, no one saw or heard from the family for about a month. Then the neighbors became concerned. John had also told them that they were going out of town. But no one was sure if Alma was going with them. The neighbors became concerned that something might have happened to the elderly woman. On December 7th, 1971, 2 officers entered the house through an unlocked window. They immediately noticed that it was unusually cold and classical music was playing. One officer said it was eerie and it reminded him of a funeral parlor. The officers made their way through the house and they found some blood on the floor. The mansion had a ballroom. The police went to that room and they found the bodies of 46-year-old Helen, 16-year-old Patricia, 15-year-old John Jr., and 13-year-old Frederick. Helen, Patricia, and Frederick had all been shot once in the head. John Jr. had been shot multiple times in the head and the back. The officers went looking for John List and his mother, Alma. On the third floor, there was an apartment. In a back room in the apartment was the dead body of 84-year-old Alma. She had also been shot in the head. The rest of the house was searched and John List was not there. The police went to John's home office and they found a 5-page letter that he had written to his pastor. In the letter, he took responsibility for the murders. He said that he was going bankrupt and he didn't want his children to grow up in poverty. He thought that poverty had sinful effects on people. He also thought that by killing his family, it would guarantee that they got into heaven. He also explained why his mother was in her apartment and not with the rest of the family. It was because she was too heavy to move. The police were able to piece together what they believed happened. 4 weeks before the body was found, on November 9th, the 3 children left for school. Helen made coffee, and she was drinking it in the kitchen. John walked up behind her, and Helen turned to look at him. He shot her in the jaw. He then went upstairs and shot his mother in the face, just above the left eye. He planned on dragging Alma's body into the ballroom, but he couldn't. John then dragged Helen's body into the ballroom and cleaned up a bit of the blood. Afterward, he wrote the letters to the children's schools. Patricia called the house around noon and said that she was sick. She asked to come home early. John drove to the school and picked up 16-year-old Patricia. When they got home, John went into the house first and hid behind a door. He shot her in the back of the head when she walked into the kitchen. He then dragged her body into the ballroom. After killing all the women in his family, he went to the post office and mailed the letters to the kids' schools. He then went to several banks and took whatever cash he could get his hands on. John then went and picked up Frederick. He brought him home, and just like he did with his daughter, he shot 13-year-old Frederick in the back of the head and then dragged his dead body into the ballroom. 15-year-old John Jr. came home not long afterward, and John shot him, but missed his head. Instead, he shot him in the back. John kept shooting him until he was out of ammo, but John Jr. kept moving. John switched guns and kept shooting his eldest son. John Jr. was shot at least 10 times. His body was dragged into the ballroom. Then John wrote the letter to his pastor. He turned the thermometer down to 50 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 10 degrees Celsius. He turned on most of the lights inside the house, except for the ballroom. Finally, he turned on the radio to a classical music station. He locked the house up and disappeared to parts unknown. A massive manhunt for John List was initiated. The problem for investigators was that John List had a 28-day head start. At that point, he could have been anywhere. He could have easily boarded a plane that was leaving the country weeks ago without raising suspicions because no one knew he had killed his family. So he could have easily fled to anywhere in the world. 2 days after the bodies were found, John's car was parked at John F. Kennedy Airport in Queens, New York. The police looked at John's background, hoping it would hold some clues as to where he may have gone. John Emil List was born in September 1925 in Bay City, Michigan. His father, John Frederick, was 26 years older than his mother, Alma. Alma had been hired as a nurse when John Frederick's first wife was dying. John's father was cold and distant. He expected Alma to raise him. The List family were devout Lutherans. The only time people saw John and his father interact was at church. Most people barely noticed John as he was growing up. He was quiet, and he often kept to himself. In high school, he was mostly a loner, and he didn't date. After high school, John joined the Army. In August 1944, when he was stationed in Louisiana, his father died. In February 1945, John was sent to Germany. In April that year, he was captured by German forces. He was eventually released and awarded the Bronze Star. He returned to civilian life in April 1946. In the fall of that year, John attended the University of Michigan to study business administration. He graduated in June 1950. Thanks to his time in the Army, he was able to take an accelerated master's program in business that summer. So by September, he had his MBA. After completing his schooling, he was hired at a prestigious accounting firm in Detroit, Michigan. But he took a leave of absence in November 1950 to serve in the Army during the Korean War. However, he never saw action. Instead, he was stationed in Virginia. In October 1951, John and a few acquaintances went out bowling in Newport News, Virginia. A young woman named Helen Taylor caught the attention of one of his friends. Helen was a widow with a 9-year-old daughter, Brenda. Her husband had been killed 6 months earlier while serving in Korea. John talked to Helen's sister, and she thought he was a nice young man. After Helen found out that John's friend had a wife, she broke it off with him. Then she and John started dating. They were married 2 months later, on December 1st, 1951. John was discharged from the army in April 1952, and he and his new wife and stepdaughter moved to Detroit so he could resume his job. Helen gave birth to Patricia in January 1955 in a hospital in Detroit. In early 1956, John was hired at a paper company that made throwaway packaging in Kalamazoo, Michigan. So the family picked up and moved to Kalamazoo. In October 1956, Helen gave birth to a son, John Jr. Their third child, Frederick, was born in August 1958. After the third child, Helen started drinking more and started using prescription drugs. Although John made a decent living, the family was having money problems. Helen loved to spend money. The children all wore expensive clothes. But their neighbors noted that Helen was never around and she never was really watching the children. Helen could usually be found on the couch drinking and reading a book. Helen also began to resent John and she tried to humiliate him. For example, she would call his office while he was driving to work. John would get to the office and find a message that read, "The baby messed his pants. If you want them changed, come home and do it." Helen had also stopped going to church, and she would leave similar messages for John at the church. Helen's daughter from her first marriage, Brenda, couldn't wait to get out of the house. When she turned 18, she moved out and married her boyfriend. In October 1959, John's company merged with another company, and he was told to look for a job elsewhere. He got a job with Xerox, and the family relocated to Rochester, New York. Part of the corporate culture was for John and Helen to attend parties. Helen would often drink too much and humiliate John by flirting with other men and talking about her first husband. John desperately wanted to move up in Xerox, but he lacked a lot of the qualities needed to be a top executive. So in the summer of 1965, he started looking for a new job. He found a job as vice president of First National Bank of Jersey City, New Jersey. After getting the job in autumn 1965, the family moved into the mansion in Westfield. The mansion had 19 rooms, including 9 bedrooms, a billiards room, and a ballroom. To afford the house, Alma moved in with them and contributed to the bills. A year into John's job at the bank, he was fired. The bank needed someone who could do sales, and John simply lacked the social skills of a salesman. John was too ashamed to tell his wife that he had lost his job. So every weekday, he would leave in the morning and go to the train station. He would hang out there all day and then return home. To cover the loss of income, he stole money from his mother's bank accounts. About 6 months after he lost his job, he got a new one at America Photographic Company in New York City. But his salary was less than half of what he used to make at the bank and Xerox. Also, Helen fell ill, and the hospital bills put more financial burden on the family. In late 1968, John quit his job and started to sell mutual funds. but he still wasn't bringing in the money he needed to fund his family's lifestyle. By October 1971, John was deeply in debt. He had taken out 3 mortgages on the house. Plus, all the household bills were outstanding. That year, he only made $5,000 from selling mutual funds. He had also spent most of his mother's money. On November 9th, 1971, John List killed his family and seemingly vanished into thin air. The police in Westfield were dedicated to finding John List, but they found nothing in his past that were clues to where he might have gone. Over the years, they received countless tips and followed up on them, but none of them led to John List. In 1989, 18 years after the murders, America's Most Wanted debuted on Fox. The show was a hit. The investigators in Westfield approached the producers and asked them to feature John List. They were initially turned down. The host of America's Most Wanted, John Walsh, explained they just had no idea where John List might have gone or what he might look like after 18 years. For 9 months, the investigators repeated their requests. The producers finally gave in. On May 21st, 1989, they aired the segment about John List. It was the coldest case that they had covered up to that point. Since they didn't have any recent photos of John, an artist was hired to create an age-progressed bust. The artist, Frank Bender, specializes in forensic sculpting. Forensic sculpting has 2 main avenues. Usually, they either create busts of Jane Doe's or John Doe's, or they sculpt busts of aging fugitives. For John List's bust, he also worked with a forensic psychologist. He wants to know the personalities of the fugitives because we don't all age the same way. For example, someone who is obsessed with their looks will not age the same way as an alcoholic smoker. They were sure John would have aged poorly and the edges of his mouth would be downturned. But he wouldn't look that way because he felt guilty. Instead, he would have looked that way because he would have had anxiety about being caught. Bender also looked at pictures of John's parents when they were older. Based on those photos, he added jowls to the face of the bust. Bender was confident that John would be wearing glasses with dark, thick frames. He did not think that John would switch to contacts because he wasn't vain in that way. Instead, he wanted to look smart and successful. America's Most Wanted prominently featured the bust during the segment. After the show aired, a call came in from Denver, Colorado. The caller was positive that the man they were talking about was her former neighbor, Robert Clark. She said that Robert and his wife had recently moved to Virginia. As the woman was watching the show, based on the description of the man being a Lutheran accountant who dressed well, she thought it might be Robert. Then she saw the bus, and because of the jowls and the glasses, she was absolutely sure that her former neighbor was John List. The tip was passed on to the FBI. On June 1st, 1989, 11 days after the show aired, the FBI arrested Robert Clark at the accounting firm where he worked in Richmond, Virginia. He denied that he was John List. He was brought to the FBI's headquarters. Robert Clark's fingerprints were compared to the fingerprints of John List. It was an exact match. After 17 and a half years on the lam, John List had been arrested for the murder of his family. Despite the fingerprint evidence, the man calling himself Robert Clark continued to deny being John List. Even after he was extradited to New Jersey in June 1989, he continued to say he was Robert Clark. What shocked many people was that the glasses that Frank Bender picked out for the bus were nearly identical to the glasses that John List was wearing when he was arrested. Several people said that it was as if John Bender was looking at List when he made the bust. John List's trial started on April 2, 1990. At this point, he had acknowledged that he was 64-year-old John List. The defense argued that John committed the murders because he had diminished mental capacity because he had obsessive compulsive personality disorder. Essentially, he was on autopilot and he couldn't stop himself. The defense argued that John should only be found guilty of second-degree murder. The defense had a major uphill battle because John had left behind the letter for his pastor and it contained a detailed confession of the murders. The trial lasted nearly 2 weeks. The jury deliberated for 9 hours. They found John List guilty on 5 counts of first-degree murder. 3 weeks later, he was sentenced to 5 consecutive life sentences. After John was arrested, convicted, and sentenced, investigators pieced together his life on the lam. In an interview for the television show American Justice, John said that he felt relieved after he killed his family. After wiping out his family, he ate a meal in the kitchen where he had killed most of his family members. He then slept that night in the house. He said that he slept better that night than the night before. The morning after he annihilated his family, John got on a train and traveled to Denver, Colorado. He told American Justice that he wanted to see the mountains and relax because he had been under a lot of stress. In Denver, he moved into a motel and took on the name Robert P. Clark. He initially got a job as a cook at a hotel restaurant. He eventually got a job preparing taxes at H&R Block. At some point, he joined a Lutheran church in Denver. In 1977, he met a woman named Dolores Miller at a church picnic. They started dating and they were married in 1985. In 1988, they moved to Midlothian, Virginia, and he got a job as an accountant. Ironically, one of John's favorite TV shows was America's Most Wanted. He even encouraged friends and neighbors to watch the show. John often wondered if they would feature him on the show. John happened to be out the night his segment aired, but he caught the tail end of it. He was shocked at how accurate the bust was. After John was arrested, his second wife, Dolores, was stunned. She had no idea that the man she had married had murdered his first family. John List said he never really felt guilty or felt any remorse over killing his family. He eventually just stopped thinking about them. John was asked how he felt about dying in prison. He said that he had accepted it and it felt like he did his years of parole before his sentence instead of afterward. He also said that he felt safer in prison than the outside world because of how some people drive and the fact that some people kill other people at random. John said that he'll probably go to heaven when he dies and when he meets up with his family, they'll probably forgive him. John List died in March 2008 at the age of 82. One of the main reasons John gave for killing his family was money troubles. The house that John murdered his family in burned down in 1972. In the ballroom, there was a stained glass ceiling. It was made by famed artist Louis Comfort Tiffany. The ceiling was estimated to be worth $100,000. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Our fact checker, producer, and sound designer was Danielle Cloutier. This episode could not have been written without the help of the book Death Sentence, the inside story of the John List murders by Joe Sharkey. I highly recommend checking it out. If you like this podcast, please subscribe or follow so you don't miss any future episodes. If you just discovered this podcast, please check out Criminally Listed on YouTube. We have nearly 300 videos featuring some unsettling and bizarre true crime stories. You can find it at youtube.com/criminallylisted. But that's all for this week. Thank you again for listening.